Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
I maybe find myself envious of Josephine Baker because she was unafraid to leave. She did not need a city or a country.
That's the poet, essayist, and cultural critic Hanif Abdurraqib reading an excerpt from his book, A Little Devil in America, Notes in Praise of Black Performance. In the book, he explores the pivotal roles that Black performers have played in American culture. Hanif examines the life of entertainer and civil rights activist Josephine Baker, the significant role that singer Mary Clayton's powerful voice played in the success of the Rolling Stones' iconic song, Gimme Shelter, and what makes the Black funeral different from other funerals. Hanif joins us from his home in Columbus, Ohio. Welcome to Beta. Good to have you back.
Thanks for having me, Doug. It's good to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you here. We just heard an excerpt from your book about the entertainer and civil rights activist Josephine Baker. And the title of your book, A Little Devil in America, comes from a speech she made at the March of Washington in 1963. Can you tell us a bit about this speech and what made it so powerful?
Yeah, it's a speech she gave kind of in the beginning part of the march. And, you know, it's a part of the march's history that I think is a bit under-remembered and under-glamorized. And the march's history is so male-centric, you know, but Josephine Baker spoke, and she was 57, which, of course, is not old, but it is much older than the crowd that knew her upon her leaving the States and perhaps had read about her performance exploits in France and beyond. I love the speech for how, it's funny, it's defiant, it's somber, but also celebratory. And there's a part of it where she kind of looks upon the younger audience and tells them to go and ask their grandparents about her, and their grandparents will tell them that she was a devil in other countries and a little devil in America too.
Mm-hmm. Josephine was born in St. Louis, Missouri, but she renounced her American citizenship and moved to Paris. During World War II, she joined the French Resistance. What exactly did she do?
She was a spy and someone who kind of passed information along and traveled with information because she could use her fame and notoriety, but also just her charm and her ability to kind of manipulate the desires of men in particular to shuttle information back and forth. And that to me is another fascinating and underreported part of her life.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a bit more about that, including why you think it's underreported?
Well, I mean, I think that it is a little bit more complex to approach Josephine Baker's fullness, and it is a lot easier for people to kind of confront her, the image of her on stage in, say, a banana suit, and the bikini of bananas, or, you know, the picture where she's kind of making playful faces at a tiger, these kind of things. But in her mid to late life and career, there's still a lot of robust brilliance that is perhaps harder to confront because she was operating in ways that are perhaps less glamorous to talk about.
And now let's run over and meet the toast of Europe.
It's nice to see you, and it's been a long time since you've been back on these shores, hasn't it?
No, only 2.5 years ago.
Well, of course, I'm thinking of the fact that originally you came from the United States.
Ah, yes, from St. Louis.
St. Louis, Missouri. Actually, St. Louis, Missouri at one time was French, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. I thank you for remembering.
Well, you know, mostly I'm fascinated by what it is to return home and to have a complicated relationship with home, but still find yourself drawn to return to it. You know, I'm someone who loves where I live and was raised a great deal and have complications with it, but still love it. And there's an interesting push and pull that comes with, I think, being Black and loving any place in America. But I especially love Josephine Baker's relationship with St. Louis and her returns to America that were not without their complications and not without her, you know, comfortably voicing those complications.
Mm-hmm. One of my favorite essays is called I Would Like to Give Mary Clayton Her Roses. For those of our listeners who may not be familiar with her, who is Mary Clayton?
Mary Clayton is a singer who is, I would say to most people, most notable for singing on the Rolling Stones song Gimme Shelter.
Can you take us back to the fall of 1969 when the Rolling Stones were working on the song that would become Gimme Shelter?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because, you know, kind of in the middle of the night, Mick Jagger, they decided that they needed a woman's voice to kind of sing through some of the chorus elements, a soulful voice, if you will. And the producer kind of got Mary Clayton out of bed, middle of the night, got her out of bed, you know, had her come down to the studio and sing, you know, what you hear. Some would consider that she sings backup vocals, but I really think about Gimme Shelter as a Mary Clayton song. And of course, it would later be a song that she sang on her own with no accompaniment from the Rolling Stones. But the most notable vocal part of her performance that I think people would recognize is the kind of buildup and repetition of the word, the lyrics, rape, murder. It's just a shot away. It's just a shot away. And during, I think, the second or third rotation of singing that, on the second syllable of murder, her voice kind of reaches a really high point and then kind of cracks a bit. And you can hear Jagger giving kind of a shout of awe in the studio, which is on the final record. And it's funny because Mary Clayton was actually not the band's first choice for the part. They had asked Bonnie Bramlett to sing, and Bonnie Bramlett's husband would not let her sing with the Rolling Stones.
What thoughts go through your mind when you listen to Gimme Shelter?
Well, I have a hard time returning to it because it, for me, whether intentional or not, it does feel, I mean, the exertion in Mary Clayton's voice is jarring for me and hard to confront. I will say that her version, the version that it's just her singing, is actually my preferred version. That is my preferred version because I think, you know, there's more, it feels like she has more autonomy over the movements of the song and she's not being pushed to heights that suggest discomfort.
Mm, yeah. Can you talk a bit about the connection between Gimme Shelter and the disaster, the murder at Altamont?
Yeah. I mean, Meredith Hunter was a young black man who at Altamont during the Rolling Stones performance was murdered by a group of Hell's Angels in 1969. And he was young, he was 18. And when the Rolling Stones were performing, he kind of approached the stage and got perhaps too close to the stage. You know, he had, and by that time at Altamont, it must be said that just much was unraveling. You know, like the Hell's Angels became more intoxicated. The crowd became kind of restless and frustrated and also intoxicated. And Hell's Angels were also becoming more antagonistic towards the crowd. And by the time Meredith Hunter kind of got to the stage, the producer of Gimme Shelter, Porter Bibb, was begging, you know, kind of begging Meredith Hunter to calm down. But he was so enraged by the behavior of the Hell's Angels, but was also intoxicated. And he was murdered by the Hell's Angels. He, for his protection, he had carried a weapon to Altamont, or, you know, because of the racism in Alameda County. And he, like, brandished the weapon, and the Hell's Angels kind of descended on him and beat him mercilessly and then stabbed him to death.
There was the reality of the hurt and pain, the ardor, the ecstasy, the suffering, and the reality that we had to confront as a black people. And don't get it twisted, she was black without apology or excuse. And she was American without argument or exception. She was black because she was from the blackest city in the world, Detroit. I know y'all jealous. You from Chicago, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh. You good, but you ain't got the D.
You have a very powerful essay about the unique experience of the Black funeral. What makes a Black funeral different from other funerals?
Well, I think at least I can only speak to the ones that I've been to. And, you know, I write an essay. I was raised going to two Muslim funerals before I went to any other funerals. And those experiences are vastly different than the traditional Black funerals I've been to in like the South or that I've witnessed if I'm thinking about Aretha Franklin's funeral. You know, there's just no concern for time or where anyone else might have to be. But there was something miraculous about that, to be present in the unfurling of that moment that seemed endless. You know, that day I turned on the funeral, Aretha's funeral, in the late morning, early afternoon. And I had to take a flight that day to be in Decatur. And I remember watching it on my phone as I got to the airport and the plane took off, and that flight's about an hour, maybe an hour, 20 minutes from Columbus. And I remember landing, getting off the plane, walking into the airport and realizing the funeral was not only still going, but it was just like maybe at that point just getting its legs, you know, just getting moving. And by the time I got to the hotel, you know, it was like an hour drive to the hotel and the funeral was still happening.
Wow.
You know, and there was something kind of miraculous about the idea that these people all conspired to come together in an attempt to not let Aretha go so easily.
Hmm. Yeah. When you were 21, you attended a funeral at a church in southern Alabama. Can you tell us about this experience?
I think that was maybe the first time I saw dance and song kind of collide in a way that was that felt celebratory in the sense of grief. And not only dance and song, but like fashion too. You know, people wearing things that the deceased loved or wearing things that the deceased passed down to them, these kind of things, where the eulogy extends to a more physical space, a space of language still, but also a space that is really rooted in a celebration of the physical nature of what was left behind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How has thinking and writing about Black funerals shaped the way you think about death?
Oh, I mean, I think, I've always thought about death with a level of, I think, a generosity and thoughtfulness and some level of gratitude. And so I don't know if, you know, the kind of thinking through the Black funeral has changed that. But I will say that, you know, it gives me a renewed sense of understanding that when someone is gone, there's still ways to keep them close to us. And there's still ways to fight to keep them alive in whatever ways we can. And there's also, you know, a big thing with me is that I realize that it is immensely important to not only look at grief and death and loss with sadness, but also to look at it with great gratitude for the fact that someone we love had a life that intersected with our own.
Mm, that's beautiful. That's very well said. You have this really great essay about Soul Train in your book, and I wanted to ask you about the role that Soul Train has played in your life.
Oh yeah, I mean, weirdly, more now than ever. You know, I have this like hard drive of now I have a hard drive of every Soul Train episode from the 70s through the 90s. Hmm. You know, I have this archive of Soul Train performances that I am just always immersed in. And yeah, I mean, I grew up watching the reruns. And there's a difference, you know, like watching the reruns was great as a kid. But the thing with the reruns is you would get the commercials would be of the day.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would kind of like pull you out of, you know, if you're watching a 1975 Soul Train rerun, but then the commercials for something from 1995, it's a different experience.
Yeah.
But with this kind of archive I have, the commercials are the commercials of the era. And it's incredible to me because I feel like I am really in the world of Soul Train as it's intended to be. And that has been really delightful.
Mm-hmm. We've had you on to talk about your love of A Tribe Called Quest. Now we've talked to you about the history of Black performance. What is next for you?
You know, I hesitate to mention this because it's so far down the road, but I am working on a basketball book, a book about LeBron James and high school basketball in Ohio and basketball movies and the idea of making it and who that idea serves. And it's funny, I mean, this is a book that I've always wanted to write and just could not figure out how to find my way to it. And now I kind of have the opportunity to, and I'm trying to take advantage of that.
Oh, very cool. We'll look forward to that. That sounds very, very interesting, amazing. Yeah. Hanif Abdurraqib, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate being here, Doug.
Hanif Abdurraqib is the author of A Little Devil in America, Notes and Praise of Black Performance. Find out more at WPR.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Bill Oakley, Lorraine Newman, and Hanif Abdurraqib. If you want to hear it again or binge on past episodes, subscribe to the Beta podcast. It's available to follow on Spotify or wherever you catch your favorite pods. Attention Alphas! Join us for a virtual Beta Film Club on Thursday evening, April 22nd. Acclaimed author Matteo Ascarapor will join us to talk about how great sales movies like The Wolf of Wall Street and Glengarry Glen Ross inspired his novel, Black Buck. For more information, visit WPR.org/presents. You can keep up with us during the week online at WPR.org/beta or on Twitter at WPRBeta. Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic!
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
As hard as it is to believe, some people don't care for me neither.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
He's in his office making a pathetic attempt to look professional.
And thanks to you, our Alphas. We'll see you next week. I'm Doug Gordon.
This is my chance to show everyone how professional I am.